Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. I am John Iderola. So much to get to today. We're going to be talking about this open letter from hundreds of former federal prosecutors about obstruction of justice and Donald Trump. Big news there. Updated polls in the Democratic primary. Massive movement for one candidate. We're going to try to break down why exactly that might be the case. And this is a big guest show, by the way. So we've got guests who are going to come on to talk about the Democratic primary and appeals to women of color in this primary. We're going to be talking about Facebook banning extremists. We're going to talk about the military pushing religion. Like, so much to get to. You're going to want to stay tuned. And near the end of the show, we're going to do our segment Meanwhile In, talk about some news from around the world. We've got bad news for animals, good news for British babies, though, so that should be fun. Before we jump into the news, though, I do want to acknowledge, I know many of you have probably been wondering, John, all yesterday I was watching the photos from the Met Gala come in, and why haven't they released any from of you yet? And the crazy thing is, I didn't get invited. Like, maybe it was an oversight, got lost in the mail or something. But no, I didn't get invited for some reason. I'm just not one of the cool kids. I know it's shocking, but I've come to grips with it, and I guess we all must. But really, I will just say about it what everyone has acknowledged. It's not just like you look at it and you think, huh, that kind of seems a little bit like the Capitol from Hunger Games. It's like that's the only thing you can think when you see it is, in a time where we're finally acknowledging income and wealth inequality and all of that, and the obvious structural things that are keeping back the vast majority of working Americans, like this extremely over-the-top, ostentatious, like, worship of more, where we take the most attractive people in society and then throw tens of thousands of dollars of clothing and makeup at them, is just mind-boggling to me. I guess it's a distraction. I guess sometimes we need distractions. I guess I'll stick with Avengers for that. Anyway, why don't we jump into the news? Just yesterday, hundreds of former federal prosecutors have signed on to an open letter attesting to what seems pretty obvious, that if Donald Trump was not the president, that he already would be facing charges over obstruction of justice based on what we learned in the Mueller report. I want to give you just a little bit from that letter. They said, each of us believes that the conduct of President Trump described in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report would, in the case of any other person not covered by the Office of Legal Counsel policy against indicting a sitting president, result in multiple felony charges for obstruction of justice. They go on to say, of course, there are potential defenses or arguments that could be raised in response to an indictment of the nature we describe here. But to look at these facts and say that a prosecutor could not probably sustain a conviction for obstruction of justice, the standard set out in principles of federal prosecution runs counter to logic and our experience. And in this particular case, there's a lot of experience, actually. So initially, 375 people had signed on to the letter, growing to 459 in the hours that it was after it was published. That includes 20 former US attorneys, more than 100 people with at least 20 years of service at the Justice Department, most of them former career officials. The signers have worked in every presidential administration since that of Dwight D. Eisenhower. So they I guess went up to someone's like bed or whatever as they were languishing there and got them to sign on this letter. But basically you have people who have experience in this field under Democrats, under Republicans. Many of them have worked in high profile jobs for previous Republican presidents, and they all agree that based on their experience, Donald Trump, if he has a defense, it is just that Office of Legal Counsel memo, which, I mean, we've said this many times before, I guess it doesn't necessarily bear saying. It is ridiculous that this one memo, a sort of idea of what the guidelines should be for indicting a sitting president, would protect him in this case. I mean, we lived through Nixon, we saw how that went. I don't understand how that is actually protection against the evidence that we have seen, the obvious obstruction of justice that happened. And look, you can read up more online about this letter. They talk a little bit about the evidence that Mueller described in his report, and we've talked about it ad nauseum. But again, like, if what Donald Trump did, what is described in the report, does not rise to the level of obstruction of justice, it just does not mean anything anymore. And the idea that a president could get away with that and that nothing would happen, I guess everyone seems to have moved on. Everyone seems to have been like, you know, the Mueller report, that was an interesting time in our history, and I guess, you know, we move on to the next thing. Let's see what happens with infrastructure, but I can't move on so easily. I don't understand why people are so complacent with flagrant breaking of the law that Donald Trump not only did just up to the limit of the worst kinds of obstruction of justice that we could imagine, where he tried to get Mueller fired and didn't actually do it himself. That would be the worst, I guess, other than possibly killing Mueller himself, that he did all of that, but obviously did it to try to hinder this investigation in every way possible. Not only by not making himself and other principal witnesses available, notably he and his son never sat down with the investigation. They tried to get people to lie to the investigators. They tried to bully witnesses into not cooperating with investigators. Every different formulation and level of severity of obstruction of justice, you can find the whole menu here. And not enough to do anything. And it causes people in positions of power and authority to say ridiculous things. Nancy Pelosi, who over the weekend said that she's worried Donald Trump won't actually step down if he loses a close election in 2020. She said yesterday that Trump appears to be goading us into impeaching him. Now, notably, she's not any closer to actually instituting any sort of impeachment proceedings or anything like that. She's just, I guess, annoyed by his behavior. Now look, him goading us or not is no reason to pursue impeachment. I would argue his constant breaking of the law would be a far better reason. But perhaps we're on that sort of personal level of politics where the only way that Nancy Pelosi is going to do what is obviously mandated by the Constitution and required by her position as a leader in the opposition party will be that he's goading her, I guess. Like, you can obstruct justice, but you can't tweet in an arrogant fashion. I don't understand what's going on anymore, but what I do understand is that a horrible precedent is being set day by day. Other people are watching, and I'm not just worried about the crimes that have been committed, and I'm not just worried about the crimes that Donald Trump will commit over the next 2 to 6 years of his presidency, assuming that that's all that he gets. It's the presidents that will come after. Republican, sure, but possibly Democrat as well, who now will be freed up from any concern that if they break the law, if they hinder the pursuit of justice, all of that, that there will be any consequences whatsoever. And it's great that these federal prosecutors have sent their letter, and it's great that Nancy Pelosi's annoyed or whatever, but this requires far greater action than that. And so far, I just don't see it. And the polls are pretty clear that I saw one yesterday that the people are sort of waning in their interest in impeachment. There was this big poll, like, people don't seem to be in favor of it. Is it any wonder? Who has been making the case over the past few weeks? Donald Trump obviously has been saying the entire thing is a witch hunt. And then you balance that with complete silence from the other side. Yes, Elizabeth Warren has said a few good things. Some people in Congress, obviously Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, AOC, other strong progressives have been making the case. But the leadership is silent. They are not making the case to the people. And so, of course, the people are going to start to listen to, you know, the uncritical just purveying of Donald Trump's quotes that you see on, we talked about on the Twitter of these mainstream media outlets. The entire thing is incredibly frustrating. And so far, I don't see much of an out here. Anyway, I do want to move to other news in the time that we have. Polls are moving quite rapidly in one direction in the Democratic primary. Joe Biden is shooting up over the past week or so since he declared his candidacy. Let's take a look at the results of this new Harris X poll. Who should be the Democratic Party's 2020 presidential nominee? And you see there, Joe Biden is at 46 points. That is a significant leap up from just a few weeks ago. Notably, back then he wasn't a candidate, but at one point he was in the very low 30s or the high 20s, sometimes just a couple of points off of Bernie Sanders. And some of the state polls actually losing to Bernie Sanders. But you see there, nationally, Sanders at 14, Buttigieg at 8, then you get to Warren and Harris, O'Rourke and Booker down at very low levels. And obviously the other candidates, and there are far more than that, are at, you know, 2, 1, or 0% of the vote right now. So what does this mean? Biden shooting up in a very short period of time to 46 points. Now, for historical context, that is not the same sort of lead that Hillary Clinton had early on in the 2016 Democratic primary. And we do have to bear in mind that this is still very early on in the process. I mean, we're at a point in the Democratic primary where, at that same point in the Republican primary in 2016, Donald Trump hadn't yet like sludged down his golden escalator yet. So we're still very early on in this process. But if you were Joe Biden, you gotta like the looks of these results, huh? I would imagine. Now, why is this? Why has he shot up so much in a very short period of time? A guy that already had near universal name recognition from his time as VP. Well, I don't know for sure, but I would like to consider a few possibilities. And one is that he has been all over the news in the past couple of weeks. Take a look at this 538 analysis of references of candidates in the news over the course of the past week. So this week, I mean, you can see the number of clips of Joe Biden referencing him this past week are basically four times as much as the next highest candidate, Bernie Sanders. And from Bernie Sanders down to Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, it's kind of tight. You're seeing some disparity there, and Bernie is the second most talked about. But there's no comparison effectively between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. Last week, Biden had more than three times as many mentions. And think about, look, there's a very good chance you don't watch tons of CNN, MSNBC. I don't. So I can't say for sure what it is that they were talking about when it comes to Joe Biden. But I have a few guesses about what it wasn't. I have a feeling it probably wasn't like, okay, we've got eight experts on healthcare. We've got people representing some people who want single payer, some people who want to just reinforce the ACA. Here is Joe Biden's detailed healthcare plan. Break it down. Have at it. That didn't happen because we don't have that plan. And similarly, you didn't have panels like that on climate change or gun control or infrastructure or rural issues or rural Wi-Fi, broadband, any of that, because we don't know any of that stuff. Look, there's been a lot of bad news for Biden coming out of past speeches and forums and debates and things like that. Were they breaking those down? Maybe. I kind of doubt that too. If anything, what kind of conversation do you think it was that they were having? You know what they were having. Joe Biden. Does he have momentum? Joe Biden, the horse race. No substance whatsoever. Not what has he actually said? What does he represent going forward for the Democratic Party? Maybe the closest thing to substance I would assume would be, can he stand up to Donald Trump? Is he taking it to Donald Trump more than the other candidates? Perhaps we got something like that. But I have a feeling it was probably no more substantive discussion than we've had out of Joe Biden himself. And my fear, and the reason I'm telling you about this 46 points, is lots can change. It can change rapidly, and it certainly can change over time. Bernie Sanders, as one example, made up a bigger gap with Hillary Clinton in 2016 than any of these candidates would need to make with Joe Biden if they wanted to eventually be the nominee. But it is a big lead, and it's the sort of lead that does not lead to a candidate taking risks. And for Joe Biden, a guy who has been very hesitant to give us any real idea of what he would do as president, going so far as to say to a crowd that he wasn't going to describe his healthcare ideas because they'd already been standing long enough and there just wasn't time. If you've got that big lead, are you really gonna start to shake things up? Are you really going to produce plans that could theoretically be attacked by the many other candidates? I don't think so. And so what I'm really relying on at this point is that the media will start to delve a little bit deeper into some of these candidates, that perhaps their natural desire to have drama, like changes in the race and in the narratives and all that, might lead them to take a second look at some of these other candidates, and that people will start to require more than Joe Biden, it's a name I know from a time I felt more comfortable in, he'll probably be like Obama. I hope that that is not what takes us through this primary, but as of right now, it looks a little bit scary. Okay, with that said, we are gonna take a short break. When we come back, guests are gonna start to join us. Lots of exciting stuff to get to after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us now to break down the current state of the Democratic primary and where we might end up going from here is National Political Director of Indivisible, Mati Urbina. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, John.
Very glad to have you here and to talk the Democratic primary with you. Obviously, there's been a lot going on. Before we get into some of the recent forums and ways that candidates have been trying to appeal to different groups, I did want to talk to you about you're from Indivisible, and there's this We Are Indivisible pledge. Could you tell me what that's all about?
Yeah, happy to. So we're really excited to roll out the We Are Indivisible pledge. It's sort of a second prong to some early work we did in early March. A year from Super Tuesday, we rolled out a sort of campaign that says primaries are dot, 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 fill in the blank. Primaries are a chance to move on our issues. Primaries are how we win. And we really wanted to open up space around primaries and encourage folks to get engaged. We know that talking about primaries and engaging in primaries can be somewhat uncomfortable, and we wanted to make sure that we were supporting the movement as they took on some of these big conversations, especially ahead of debates. We want to make sure that folks have are supported in their organizing, regardless of where they are with all the candidates. It's early yet, but we want to make sure they're not afraid of the issues and that they're going to jump right in. So in order to jump right in, we know that everyone needed to be squarely in the same place next summer. We know folks needed to be reassured that we'd all come together next summer, no matter who the Democratic nominee is. And so that was the thinking behind the pledge. We also wanted to make sure that we had not just a pledge for candidates to come together and really encourage and set the tone early, but also for the grassroots to come together. And so we've had enormous excitement and engagement. We have over 27,000 people who've signed the grassroots pledge. We have 14 candidates, presidential candidates, more than half of everyone who's filed declare, you know, pledge with us that they're going to do this. And so we're just really excited. Again, it's not to gloss over differences. It's not to say there isn't going to be a real contest of ideas, but it is to say that we need to stay focused on the issues, the vision, how folks intend to govern, how folks intend to bring together a broad multiracial coalition of voters so that we can all win together next summer.
And in terms of the differences, I mean, you have of presidential candidates that have already signed on to it. You have from the most progressive candidates down to, you know, like self-declared centrists. So there are people of all sorts that have already signed on to it. I imagine that your group must have sort of requests out to the other candidates to get them to sign on as well.
Yeah, that's right. So we were really excited that Senator Sanders was the first one to join the pledge. And then shortly thereafter, everyone followed Senator Booker, Senator Harris, Senator Warren. We have a lot of really amazing candidates. And even some of the, you know, the more recent folks like Beto and Swalwell and others. And so we're really excited, Senator Harris. We're really, really excited by the spectrum of candidates. We have candidates who are really encouraged about doing the work early together around this, you know, this frame of coming together and being strong and unified. I think it's been a great tool so far, and we want to encourage other candidates to join us. I will note that Vice President Biden is not on the pledge yet, but we do invite him to join it, and we will continue to reach out.
And I would be very surprised if he did not sign on to that. He doesn't seem like if he were to lose, he's going to launch a third party bid or anything like that. So I would assume that it's probably a matter of time.
I hope it's coming.
I hope so. You recently organized a couple of different presidential forums, the She the People and We the People presidential forums. What did you notice in there? Were there patterns to the sorts of statements that would get a big reaction from the crowd at those forums? Were there particular candidates that stood out as being received very favorably?
Yeah, so we were partners in the work and supportive of a lot of movement partners who helped create space. So the first one, the We the People Forum, was a democracy-focused forum that encouraged the grassroots to be right here in the nation's capital, asking these candidates for the first time what their plans were around democracy and all of the different types of democracy, right? Whether it's voting rights, whether it's a filibuster, whether it's electoral college questions. It was sort of the whole gamut, and that was really interesting. Interesting because there is sort of not just this ask for where are candidates on the issues, but what are their views for systemic change? What are their views for enacting some of their big ideas? And then She the People was organized by Amy and others like Jessica Byrd, who wanted to bring to life their vision of having women of color courted, centered early in the race so that the claims and the concerns of women of color were part of the race, not as an afterthought, but as a real center and a pillar. And I think You know, we were supportive partners, but we were really excited to be there. We had Indivisible group leaders in both the We the People Forum and the She the People Forum in Houston. And it's, I gotta tell you, it's really fun as someone who's organizing around these issues to watch the candidates have an arc in these spaces, because you really do see them have an arc, at least the ones that are like really tapping into the energy, really trying to reflect on how they're doing, really trying to learn from the pain points that folks are offering when they're in these spaces. The, you know, all the individuals who ask these candidates questions. Mm. I hope that all the candidates are taking that information and making their platforms more humanized, more real, more authentic to how they make their case to voters.
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned appeals to women of color. I wanted to ask you about one of the female candidates, Elizabeth Warren, recently has had a bit of movement in the polls, including in one poll actually moving into second place, slightly above Bernie Sanders. What do you attribute her recent success to?
So one thing that really jumped out in that space to just to bring to life is folks were really drawn to her specifics, both from her policy prescriptions, but also in the way that she answered the questions. She gave you a full story. She gave you a story of how she champions issues, but she also gives you a story that brings you in, that helps you understand, you know, the racial wealth gap, that helps you understand why homeownership among Black Americans and white Americans have widened so much in the last few decades. And so I think that's really powerful when a candidate like Elizabeth Warren can specifically name the pain points, name the ways in which our history, our laws have clearly not met the mark in universally helping all Americans, even when that's been the intention in our public policy, and then talks about how we can really fix it and have the courage and clarity to do so. And sort of having that entire arc of making the case to voters, being clear, letting them know you're talking about them, it really goes a long way and it shows. And I would say the other piece that really stood out to me, I've been watching Elizabeth Warren closely since last summer at Netroots, and it's very, very clear to me that she has a lot of public forums under her belt. She has prioritized being accessible to people, right, both from her fundraising strategy, but also the amount of time she's been out in the public in these very wide public forum spaces where she's telling you her story, she's bringing you in, and she's doing it over and over again, and it shows. I would say that I was a little bit critical last summer in some of the analyses that was presented. And I would say that she walked onto that stage, both at We the People and She the People, and she clearly felt comfortable and confident in it at showing. And I mean, the fact that her, you know, I have a plan for that is taking off, and that she's leaning into sort of being wonky and authentic, I think it's helpful. And I think it's helpful for the contest of ideas, right? It's helpful for the things that we all really care about, to make these issues accessible to everyday people.
I couldn't agree more. Mati Urbina, National Political Director of Indivisible, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you so much.
And for you watching at home, we'll see you on the other side. An official VA display, including a Bible, has prompted a lawsuit. And joining us now to talk about that lawsuit is founder and president of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, Michael Weinstein. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you. Please call me Mikey.
Mikey, thank you. And welcome to the show. Tell us about this lawsuit. What exactly prompted it?
Well, our foundation represents a little bit, around 64,000, give or take. It's always going up. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps members, active duty and civilians, and veterans. About 95% of our clients are actually Christians themselves that are being persecuted for not being Christian enough, as it were, John. In late January this year, we were reached out to by 14 veterans, 9 of them Christians, the others Jewish, Muslim, atheist, and agnostic Native American, at the Manchester, New Hampshire Veterans Administration Medical Center. They were upset about the fact that a Christian Bible was placed on this revered POW MIA table. And we've been around 15 years, 14 or 15 years. We face these all the time. So I contacted a guy named Corey Beam, who was one of the senior staff people to the director there. He told me he was a former Marine, I guess. He totally understood. He sent me 3 hours and 1 minute later, they pulled the Bible off the table. He sent an email saying, you know, you're right. Please tell your clients we're going to be more inclusive, you know, clearly indicating that this was wrong. And we had a great victory that we've had many of these. Mm-hmm. Within a 2 or 3 weeks later, suddenly the Bible appeared over the weekend back on that POW table, this time with a force field around it. plexiglass transparent plastic case that was bolted to the table, which is very much like, you know, sticking the middle finger up to all other veterans. It's like a gang sign of, hey, we're in charge. We've ever had a better example of fundamentalist Christian, I don't know, domination, supremacy, triumphalism, exceptionalism than this. We added a 15th client, who is the one Mr. Jim Chamberlain, who became our plaintiff in the lawsuit that we just filed a few hours ago earlier this morning. And Jim is a devout Christian, a former Air Force pilot. But, you know, you can't just put the Christian Bible on a POW MIA table in the building of an organization that would be called a state actor like the VA or the various branches of the U.S. military. If you're Hobby Lobby or Chick-fil-A, John, not a problem. You're a private company. I don't happen to personally patronize those organizations or those companies, but they're private. The VA is a state actor, and you can't do that. You know, the VA, by the way, John, recognizes, I think it's over 40 different religions for the headstones in their cemeteries. I recently buried my own father at a large VA cemetery here in New Mexico, and his grave has a Star of David on it because we're Jewish. But there are 39, 40, 41, 42 other religions recognized there, and the Department of Defense recognizes something like 220 to 240. So why would it be okay to put a Bible on this revered table and tell everyone, this is for you, everybody? Because you see, it's not. Mm-hmm. This is not a complex case. So the VA told us to pound sand. We said five words to them. Tell it to the judge.
Yeah. So I'm curious. So I did a little bit of research on these displays. It's not something that I had been personally familiar with before. For people who might not be familiar with these displays, what purpose are they intended to serve, and what generally is supposed to be involved in these displays?
Well, there's our senior research director, Chris Rada, is one of the experts on this. These displays started with a group of military members during the Vietnam War, I think 1966. They were called the River Rats in Vietnam. And they wanted to come up with a way to very solemnly and in a sacred fashion recognize the contributions of our POWs and our missing in action. Some of our MIAs are never found.
Yeah.
And so they came up with a table. They had various symbols on the table, much like a Passover Seder. We have symbols on a Passover plate. There was never a Bible on any of these for nearly a third of a century until the very late 1990s, early 2000s, when I think the veterans one of the ladies' auxiliaries for the, I think, Veterans for Foreign Wars, one of the organizations, decided to do it. And suddenly, I guess other people caught on, and we found this happening in a lot of places. We've seen them, we've had them reported to us on submarines, on aircraft carriers, on aircraft that are flying, military bases, VA hospitals, all over the place. Until I'd say the summer of 2016, when Trump became the presumptive nominee, we won most of these. And we still are winning a bunch of these, but we clearly saw an emboldenment of Christianity first. That Bible, that Christian Bible, is going to be good enough for you, Native American, for you, Jewish member, for you, agnostic, secularist, atheist. It's going to be good for everybody. And if you don't get it, then you are really victimizing Christians. And what I always say, John, to you baseball fans out there, when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947. That was not white Major League Baseball player victimization. It was white Major League Baseball player equalization. Same with the feminist movement in the 70s, not male victimization, male equalization. The civil rights movement in the 60s, not white victimization, white equalization. And you cannot put your gang sign, your Christian Bible, on that sacred POW MIA table and say it's there for everyone, particularly when the VA itself represents scores of other religions and acknowledges them. How hard is this to understand? Why are we talking about this, you know?
I believe that I understand it. Let me ask you a quick follow-up. In the cases, because you've had cases like this before where Bibles have been placed in these displays, you've had them removed. Have you had any cases in which, because they'll come up with a particular reason in any of these individual cases why this particular Bible needs to be there. Has that case been made to have a copy of the Quran or the Torah or some other, something by, like, some evolution textbook? Has there been anything like that placed on the tables as well, or has it always been Bibles?
We've always come back saying, can you imagine in Manchester, New Hampshire, if they put Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion or Christopher Hitchens' God Is Not Great, kind of the Bibles of atheists or agnostics, as it were, or if you put a Quran on there, there'd be blood in the streets. You ought to see the hate mail we have coming in the last couple hours or so about, you wouldn't do this if it was a Quran. Of course we would. But it's never a Quran or a Torah. I will tell you that as a US Air Force wing commander, I will not tell you his or her name, at a large military installation that that commands a number of nuclear weapons. We had a situation about a year ago with his or her command, and that wing commander came back and said, you know, you're right. He or she ordered the Bible off and replaced it, you're gonna love this, with a generic book of faith, which had readings and some thoughtful statements from Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, and a bunch of pages left intentionally blank for non-faith traditions. And it wasn't a perfect solution, but it was decent enough. And it was, they understood, this commander understood clearly the situation. We've had many VA centers and other military installations that pull it off, immediately recognizing we can't put that there. We can't put that there because that makes that a Christian entity. So we often get I often tell the media, and I'll say it right now, can you imagine if we put a Quran there, or the Book of Satan, or the manual, revered text for the Jedi Church? We have 12 clients here that are members of the Church of the Jedi right out of Star Wars. We don't care about their philosophy or their faith. We only care about the time, John, place, and manner in which they feel they can deploy their faith. And as long as it's in accordance with the US Constitution, the construing federal state case law, and all of the directives, instructions, and regulations of the Department of Defense and the VA, we're good. We're not good here. Like I said, this is a gang sign. You're flipping off the middle finger, particularly when you encase it and bolt it to the table, saying, go ahead. And, you know, you're putting a chip on saying, knock it off. And 10 of our 15 clients in Manchester are already practitioners of the Christian faith, and our one named plaintiff, Mr. Jim Chamberlain, very courageously is a devout Christian. And our lawyers, the Nixon Vogelman Law Firm, Larry Vogelman, have a long history of supporting veterans' causes there. So we're very hopeful for this case.
Yeah. Well, Mikey Weinstein, thank you for joining us. We'll certainly be watching as this court case proceeds, and the best of luck to you.
And thank you guys for doing what TYT does. It's a voice of clarity out there in a jungle of hell. So we appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm going to have to put that as a subtitle in my book. Thank you very much. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, more to get to. Just last week, Facebook banned a number of far-right individuals and organizations for the messages that they were using the platforms to spread. And joining us now to break this down and see where we might go on social media from here, Deputy Director of Extremism at Media Matters, Christina Lopez. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. We appreciate your perspective on this. So when Facebook made this move last week, banning both individuals and organizations, InfoWars obviously pretty notably, were you surprised that Facebook took such like strong and decisive action against a number of people?
Well, not really surprised. It was an action that came, if only, too late, because this is something that a lot of activists, that a lot of people who are on the other side of, you know, being targeted by the kind of rhetoric that these individuals constantly employ on these platforms had been raising the alarm for a while. And from our perspective, from the Media Matters perspective, we had been following what types of content these individuals posted on these platforms, because it did put Facebook and its platforms, Facebook and Instagram, on a really weird position consistency-wise, because on the one hand, they would tout these community guidelines, these terms of service, and claim that they would enforce them very strongly. And then on the other hand, you had an individual like Alex Jones and InfoWars, who had already been banned from the platform for multiple reasons, for hateful rhetoric, for, you know, actually calling for violence against Special Counsel Mueller at the time. And so this had been like not only egg on Facebook's face in the sense that Alex Jones had already been banned, and organizations like Media Matters had pointed out consistently how Alex Jones and other InfoWars pages had just simply circumvented any ban by starting a different account or going on Instagram to use the platform to attract users to their own platforms, to send traffic to other sites, while seemingly, you know, presenting kind of a lifestyle sort of content on Instagram. And so using Instagram as a very useful tool to whitewash their appearance online, whitewash their personal brands, while at the same time with this sanitized image, send audiences to their other sites online and increase their traffic. So we pointed out the ways in which they were doing these things and circumventing bans and going around, you know, what Facebook makes as their very explicit community guidelines and terms of service in terms of what can be content. And it showed that they were basically using, you know, loopholes or just straight just violating guidelines and content, specifically Laura Loomer with her anti-Muslim, like recurrently anti-Muslim rhetoric that was very hateful.
So I want to talk about some of the counter arguments to the move that Facebook made. There are some people who try to make it like a First Amendment thing, but then there are others who oppose these people, the message that they're sending, but they think that this might be either not effective in silencing the message or even counterproductive, that taking them off the platform feeds into their victimhood narrative and that they'll inevitably find other places to spread the message, so it won't actually sort of harm their ability to raise money and organize and all of that. In MediaMatters experience, when they've seen individuals that have been taken off of these platforms, does that appear to be the case, or do these sorts of bans, are they actually effective in harming their ability to spread these hateful messages?
Well, John, they're absolutely effective in the sense that Alex Jones, his audience largely started decreasing after he was banned from different platforms. It's not so much about free speech here. The issue at hand here is more, are you entitled to profit from your hateful speech? Mm-hmm. And are community guidelines that these platforms claim to follow and, you know, terms of service that these platforms claim are the rules of the game, are they being consistently enforced, or, you know, is there a double standard? And we found actually that there is a double standard, because while these figures are able to amass a large amount of following and, you know, increase their audiences and their viewership by, you know, impressive numbers, they would have not done this if it wasn't because of the help of algorithms that, you know, help content that is provocative, that is often hateful, become the most engaged with content and therefore get a boost from algorithms. So that largely helps. It's not so much that whether you're allowed, you know, to have a soapbox and spread your message, is whether you're entitled to a megaphone to reach even more people and actually profit from this message. What we've seen, though, is that often the terms of service are used against people of color. They're used to silence the victims of this sort of hateful racism. We've seen Facebook ban activists of color just because, you know, they were talking about double standards, or they were talking about white people in ways that made Facebook act as if, you know, white populations were a protected group. And so this false equivalences that Facebook is making in its platforms, in which, you know, groups that are just thinly veiled white supremacy, like White Lives Matter or like All White Pride, are treated as if they were perfectly equivalent to activist groups like Black Lives Matter. And so that is a problem, because you are enforcing a set of rules affecting the people who are already victims of this sort of hateful rhetoric and different systems of oppression. And you are enforcing them to actually protect the people who espouse this sort of hateful rhetoric. So, and these double standards are where MediaMatters has kind of dived into with, you know, our research and our monitoring of social media sites in ways where we show how, you know, the enforcement is inconsistent. It favors the extremists and it allows them to profit from this sort of hateful speech.
Yeah.
It isn't so much whether you're allowed to say X or Y or Z. It's that platforms empower extremists to make of these sort of rhetoric a brand, a profit, an income source. And it's also like the impact that this has on their followers. You can think about these personalities to use, you know, a name for these ages as influencers in hate. influencers in hateful rhetoric. And therefore, like the influence that they have on young followers and the influence that they have in normalizing this sort of hateful rhetoric is very important. And we've seen that, you know, everything that's said on the internet, you can't really be sure that is it falling into the ears or into the mindset of someone that is already violent, that is already prone to violence, and that, you know, has become increasingly radicalized by the sort of exposure that they've had online. Like, we've seen this, how the internet culture has played a huge role in the past, in recent hate crimes that have affected big numbers of people from protected groups.
I certainly agree, and for that reason, we appreciate the work that Media Matters does. Christina Lopez, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, John.
We're gonna take a short break. We come back, news from around the world, and meanwhile in. And now it's time for news from around the world, and meanwhile in. Meanwhile, in the UK, we've got a baby. Prince Henry and the Duchess of Sussex, I believe, Meghan Markle, they had a kid. And we haven't seen the kid yet, but Harry did come out and he gave a couple of words about the experience. He said, as every father and parent will ever say, you know, your baby is absolutely amazing, but this little thing is absolutely to die for, so I'm just over the moon. It's been the most amazing experience I could ever have possibly imagined. How any woman does what they do is beyond comprehension. He went on to say, actually, I really don't understand it. I think it's magic. But he said it in an English accent, so it sounded smarter. What do we know about this baby? Well, the baby is seventh in line to the throne behind the Prince of Wales, the Duke of Cambridge and his children, Prince George, Princess Charlotte, Prince Louis, and Prince Harry, presumably also Tommen and Joffrey and Tyrion and all of them. I don't really know. I haven't seen the baby yet, but I can say based on what I've learned, both from this research and also from Brooke, the producer, she told me a lot about this family. I can say that baby could probably star in a show called Babies I Don't Care About. Honestly, who cares about the baby? I don't care about the baby. I'll cover it, but I don't care about that baby. I'm totally joking. I'm happy for Harry and for Meghan Markle, more her for obvious reasons. But I would say that I'm exactly as happy for them as I am for literally anyone else who has a baby that's not me. I assume I'd be happier for me. The whole thing is bizarre. Man, Brooke knows so much about the royal family. I could not trace the Targaryen family tree like she could trace this current one. Anyway, I'm obviously tongue in cheek. I'm happy for them. Royalty is ridiculous. It just is. The whole thing makes no sense whatsoever. Meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in Egypt, they are taking renewable energy extremely seriously by opening up this massive solar array. It's a $2 billion project set to be the world's largest solar installation. It's been partly funded by the World Bank, which invested $653 million. And importantly, Egypt plans to meet 20% of its energy needs from renewable sources by 2022, not far in the future, up to 40% in just a little bit longer. As of right now, only 3% comes from renewable energy. And so, looking at this, on the one hand, I want to say it is going to be very difficult for them to hit that sort of target. But then I also acknowledge it's going to be really hard for us to hit that sort of target. And they apparently are taking major steps to do that. I mean, they're building literally the largest solar array. And with more projects like that, both in Egypt and around the world, we can make significant progress, but we do have to take it seriously. And the investment is going to be significant. These are not small numbers, obviously, but there are gains every year after that, not just in, you know, their operating costs are now lower than coal and natural gas and all of that, but obviously in the health benefits for the people in Egypt and around the world. This should be taken as massive inspiration for us as we look to meet those same sorts of targets. Unfortunately, we don't have time to get to the other story for Meanwhile In. We will cover it in detail tomorrow. Thank you, everybody, for watching this episode of The Damage Report. We'll be back tomorrow with J.R. Jackson and lots more news for you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.